This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Cameroon's military has taken over two villages held hostage by separatists the government says are terrorists. The suspects had been collecting taxes, rendering justice in their law courts, and sentencing people who refuse collaborating with them to prison time.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting for us. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, Kenya's attorney general says swearing in an alternative president would be an act of treason. And an expert in transitional justice says the new administration in Zimbabwe must acknowledge the ruling ZANU-PF party's role in human rights violations if it's to be credible domestically and internationally.
We'll have these stories and more just ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Cameroon's military has taken over two villages held hostage by separatists, the government says, are terrorists. The suspects had been collecting taxes, rendering justice in their law courts, and sentencing people who refused collaborating with them to prison time. Moki Edwin Kinzeka revisited the two villages in the English-speaking Southwest and reports.
Hundreds of people have returned to the Bafia's market in southwestern Cameroon nearly 2 months after they fled. Bafia is one of two villages that local government authorities said was occupied by separatists that they describe as suspected terrorists. 31-year-old Eno Bazil says he and about 100 villagers were arrested by the armed groups and detained at a local government school where a man calling himself General Armstrong, leader of the group, had installed his headquarters.
Took them here, flogged them, and you pay from 100,000 francs and above. And then when you come, they tie your eye, they beat you up. If you don't have that money, they promise to take your life. So people were paying more than 100 and something people paid that money. And they always attack trucks that are carrying cocoa to Douala. They attack them. Each pay 50,000 francs to pay a pass. Because if you don't pay, you will not pass. You will not carry cocoa to Douala.
Moyenge village, situated some 10 kilometers from Bafia, was another village that the armed separatists occupied for a month. Resident Ayuk Lucas says the invaders were judging and sanctioning anyone who did not respect them.
They even create a court, everything, a whole government, where they send bike to come and collect somebody, send it there and ask you to pay some money to them.
Last week, Cameroon military arrested 20 members of the armed group, but their supporters are still distributing recordings that preach their doctrine of total independence of the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. Moyenge resident Ebune Francis says the armed separatists are expressing anger over what he describes as the total negligence the government of Cameroon has manifested on the English-speaking regions. He says he, however, does not support secessionists, but stands for the early demands of the federal state that were made by teachers and lawyers when they began a strike more than a year ago that later degenerated.
We have been supporting the government, but nothing is coming. That's why we all are annoyed. Yeah, abandoned by the government. We don't have voters. We don't have elections. Do you want us to be happy with the government? No.
There are fears the armed separatists may be nearby. They have attacked and killed members of the military and police within the past 2 weeks. The government said it had dismantled some of their training camps, but officials said some of the fighters were crossing over to be trained in Nigeria. Peter Mbua, traditional ruler of Bafia village, says he has appealed to the government of Cameroon to assure people's safety.
I would appeal to the government to create a brigade here or a military base that will take care of this security issue here.
The government has assured the population of the English-speaking regions that it will assure their safety. Schools have been closed in most of the English-speaking Northwest and Southwest since November last year, when lawyers and teachers called for a strike to stop what they contend is the overuse of the French language. Violence erupted when separatists joined in and started asking for complete independence of an English-speaking state. On the 1st of October, they declared what they called the independence of the Republic of Ambazonia and asked the military to surrender and join them or leave their territory. They have so far killed at least 11 soldiers and policemen. In response, President Biya labeled them as terrorists and declared war on them. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bafia, Southwestern Cameroon.
Kenya's Attorney General says swearing in an alternative president would be an act of treason. Githu Muigai's warning at a press conference in Nairobi comes just days before opposition leader Raila Odinga expects to be inaugurated by an unofficial People's Assembly. Such an inauguration could worsen rifts opened by a divisive election season in which more than 70 people died in political violence. Odinga and Kenya's president Uhuru Kenyatta faced off at the polls in August. Kenyatta was declared the winner, but the Supreme Court nullified the vote. A repeat election was held in October, and Odinga and his supporters boycotted that vote, saying reforms were needed to prevent irregularities. Kenyatta won again, this time with 98% of the vote. So far, 12 Kenyan counties have passed motions supporting the formation of a People's Assembly. Most of those counties had backed the opposition during the elections. Odinga plans to be inaugurated on December 12th, which is Kenya's Independence Day. While Attorney General Muigai did not mention any names, he said the People's Assemblies proposed by Odinga's National Super Alliance are illegal. Under Kenyan law, treason is punishable by death.
An expert in transitional justice says the new administration in Zimbabwe must acknowledge the ruling ZANU-PF party's role in human rights violations if it's to be credible domestically and internationally. Dara Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Piers Pigou with the Crisis Group says it's naive to think that because Robert Mugabe is no longer president of Zimbabwe, that human rights violations by the state and its proxies will stop.
Zimbabwe has a long history of torture and abuse, and many, many tens of thousands of people have been at the receiving end of violence. And this is why fear and violence and intimidation have been critical currencies, and to a large extent will remain so in Zimbabwe unless there is a proper acknowledgement and a proper way of engaging that.
Pigou, the Crisis Group's senior consultant for Southern Africa, has worked for two truth commissions. He also helped establish the Zimbabwe Torture Victims Project, assisting them with their medical, psychosocial, and legal needs. He has investigated atrocities like disappearances for the Truth Commissions of South Africa and East Timor. He says Zimbabwe's past contains the same issues that could warrant a similar inquiry into the past. But at this stage, Pigou is doubtful this will happen because, unlike in South Africa and East Timor, the same party still governs Zimbabwe. Its new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, is alleged to have had a role in past abuses.
It seems unlikely, given the primary perpetrating role of the ruling party, and it is alleged of its new chief executive, that these issues are going to receive a thorough airing in the short to medium term future. This is a huge concern going forward, and I think, again, presents an additional challenge in terms of any meaningful efforts to break with the past. It requires an acknowledgement and an ownership of violations, which it seems highly unlikely that ZANU-PF is going to engage with.
So far, Mnangagwa has denied any responsibility for the so-called Kukurahundi killings of Mugabe's perceived opponents in Matabeleland in the early 1980s, even though he was security minister at the time. And he has been silent on 2005's Operation Murambatsvina to clear city slums, which are strongholds of opposition groups and on other crackdowns.
It was interesting in his inaugural speech that he held out an olive branch to white farmers, yet said absolutely nothing about the victims of Kukurahundi, the victims of Murambatsvina, in which he was part of that government.
Pigou says Mnangagwa is likely to pedal softly around accountability for the past. He's convinced that many Zimbabweans are ready for a truth and reconciliation system.
The first sort of transitional justice conference in Zimbabwe was back in 2001. So civil society and so have been discussing and chewing on these issues for a long time. And I think that bodes well for putting together in the future a well thought through process that...
Pigou says it'll be complicated because a commission would likely not only focus on the actions of ZANU-PF, but also, for example, on those of the security forces during whites-only rule in the 1960s and 1970s. But he maintains none of this will be possible unless the culture of fear that permeates Zimbabwe is broken.
Will Mr. Mnangagwa's new government be party to reinforcing those feelings of fear? Or will the kind of spirit that we saw break out during the 10 days or so that led to Mr. Mugabe resigning, will that spirit that's been sort of popped out of the bottle, will they be able to force it back into the bottle? We simply do not know.
What we do know, says Pigou, is that the new government has wasted no time in following the path worn by the state under Mugabe. It already has arrested and charged several political opponents rather than trying to reconcile with them. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
If you listen closely, you'll hear Zimbabwe's new president speaks a different political language than Robert Mugabe did. And in some cases, President Emmerson Mnangagwa's actions complement his words. Reporter Kudzai Shinavashe explains the case against critics who were persecuted under Mugabe's rule.
Martha O'Donovan, a 25-year-old American, was arrested in Zimbabwe early this month, accused of insulting President Robert Mugabe and trying to subvert a constitutional government. Sam Farai Monroe is the creative director and co-founder of Magamba Network, where O'Donovan works.
Her remand hearing was supposed to be Friday, 24th November. We appeared in court and it was remanded again to the 8th of December. Now the case has been postponed again, so it seems to be dragging on and on.
Following O'Donovan's arrest, authorities raided the Magamba Network offices.
It happened about 1.5 weeks after Martha's arrest, literally the day the tanks were rolling into the streets and as the coup was actually taking place. Our offices were raided by CID from the Law and Order Division. They confiscated all Magamba laptops that they found on allegations of subverting constitutional government.
The organization's work in new media, the arts and in activism caught the attention of the Mugabe government.
The projects that are very much being targeted by the state are our Magamba TV, through which we produce a lot of the top political satire shows, The Week and Zambezi News, and also our Be the Media project, through which we run the popular Twitter handle Open Pali, where young citizen journalists tweet live from parliament and from other political events.
The government under Mugabe cracked down on critics with strict laws restricting speech. A group of four men have an ongoing court case for booing former First Lady Grace Mugabe at a rally. Another journalist has a case for reporting that Mrs. Mugabe had donated used underwear. And today, a court acquitted political activist Ivan Mawarire of charges similar to those O'Donovan faces. Prosecutors under Mugabe pushed all these arrests. Political analyst Eldred Masunungure says he thinks such cases still must proceed through courts, but the outcomes may be milder than in past cases.
I think those probably will fall by the wayside, but of course, you know, rule of law dictates that those cases run their course, but I don't think the state, you know, will be insisted, on getting them persecuted beyond what they have already suffered.
While these cases may eventually be thrown out, new cases are coming to the courts, including those of politicians accused of corruption, fraud, and abusing office while serving in Mugabe's administration. But others say that under new President Emmerson Mnangagwa, the rule of law could not be worse than under Mugabe. For VOA, this is Kudzai Shinavashe from Harare.
A over now to Malawi, where a media watchdog organization is pushing the government to start implementing the Access to Information Law, which Parliament passed last year. It empowers the public and the media to request information from government officials and institutions. The government says it does not have enough resources to start implementing the law, but the Media Institute for Southern Africa in Malawi, which has been in the forefront pushing the passing of the bill, is critical of the delays. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
The bill was introduced in 2006, but delayed for 12 years before debated in Parliament last February. This was largely because of the various reviews and scrutiny it underwent before being approved for debate. President Peter Mutharika finally signed it into law last year. But authorities say they cannot start implementing the measure because various sectors of society need to be trained on how to access and disseminate the needed information. Patrick Semper is the commissioner for the Malawi Human Rights Commission, tasked to oversee the process leading to the implementation of the legislation.
If the law takes effect today, for instance, there will be total chaos because information seekers will have no idea how they go about looking for information. Information providers in the public institutions or private institutions, they'll have no clue because they've not been trained.
But Sempele says Malawians should therefore wait a bit longer before the law is implemented.
I think it should be a matter of months. I would foresee that this law should be able to take effect, definitely not after a year.
Teresa Temwekandanga is the president of MISA Malawi. She says the delay is too long.
It's a bit worrying for us. We were celebrating when the president assented to it in February this year, but up to now, 10 months down the line, it's still not operational. So we'd want the minister to set a date for implementation of this law.
Government spokesperson Nicholas Dawusi said that the government cannot set the date until it finds money to fund the implementation.
There's no delay. We are laying down procedure. Creation of structures. Yeah, that's what we are doing. It involves money. It's not as easy as people are saying.
MISA Malawi is currently holding meetings with various communities across the country on the legislation for the Access to Information Law. Ndanga says many people have told them how authorities are taking advantage of absence of the law to hide information concerning developmental projects in their areas.
For example, we had testimonies of development committees would go to the DC's office to ask on why certain projects are not finishing in time, and they'll be told off and actually being told that if they continue demanding for such information, probably maybe development won't be coming to their areas. So we think that this is derailing development in a way.
About 21 out of 54 countries in Africa have now access to information law. These include Nigeria, Uganda, and South Africa. Karabo Raju is the media advocacy coordinator for a not-for-profit Amabungane Center for Investigative Journalism, which had been advocating for the smooth implementation of the ATI law in South Africa. She says she supports MISA Malawi's push for putting the measure into practice as soon as possible.
It's absolutely justifiable. This is probably the one piece of legislation which must be implemented as quickly as possible. And what we've seen in South Africa, as well as other countries which have either implemented access to information laws, media being vigilant in reporting and investigating why things are going wrong in society, why things in government are going wrong.
Raju said in South Africa, it took only about 9 months for the government to start implementing the law, which was promulgated in the year 2000. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
As the self-declared Islamic State crumbles in Syria and Iraq, counter-terrorism officials in Maghreb and U.S. experts are rethinking tactics and strategies to deal with battle-hardened fighters returning home. Experts argue that tactics to counter terrorism in the region should pay more attention to social media and the root cause of extremism. VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi has the story.
It might seem that the fall of the Islamic State Caliphate would close a terrible chapter in the Middle East. But with the return of thousands of its fighters to their respective countries in North Africa, a new chapter is about to begin. Nowhere more so than in Tunisia, where an estimated 6,000 of its young citizens left to join the Islamic State. the arrival of those fighters to their respective countries could strengthen the capabilities of local extremist groups. Counter-terrorism officials from Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia participated in a conference in Washington to discuss threats of terrorism in the region and the best ways to face them. Rear Admiral Kamel Akrout is the National Security Advisor to the President of Tunisia. He says his country is facing a direct terrorist threat from neighboring Libya and from fighters returning from Syria and Iraq. That's why Tunisia has prepared a wide range of measures.
We have adopted some temporary restrictive measures regarding returnees, foreign terrorist fighters, with a tailor-made approach, rehabilitation, reintegration, etc., with the travel ban, contact ban, area ban, duty to report, enforcement by electronic devices, and deradicalization program in the prisons.
Akrout says there is an urgent need for security cooperation between North African countries because terrorists are sharing logistics with networks of organized crime and smugglers. Algeria has been facing violent extremists since 1992 and has gained deep experience in combating terrorism. Ambassador El-Hawass Riashi is counselor for international security issues at the Algerian Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Terrorism was defeated in Algeria through the combination of a large set of military, political, economic, social, religious, cultural, and educational policies and strategies.
He says the challenge now is to control Algeria's borders with Libya, which became a final resort for many foreign fighters. Ambassador Mohamed Saleh Tamek is Delegate General of the Penitentiary and Reintegration Administration in Morocco. He strongly believes that detaining the returning fighters is not the best way to prevent them from committing acts of terrorism in their respective countries. Instead, he shared Morocco's strategy to deal with them.
It is reconciling the offender with himself. Psychologically. Second, reconcile him with the community and bring him to do something to community. And third, reconciliation with the religious text. These people, they are being misled by wrong ideas about jihad, about tawheed, about so many concepts in Islam.
Regardless of the demise of the Islamic State Caliphate, the Islamic State will undoubtedly have major implications for North African security. That's why experts like Christine Wormuth, former U.S. Undersecretary of Defense, argues for more attention to extremist digital presence, the so-called virtual caliphate.
Denying the virtual safe haven, where we see so much of the counter-radicalization happening and where I think we've seen a lot of these groups develop very sophisticated media strategies to get out their narrative, to do recruitment that sadly has been very effective.
Without pluralistic expression, political opposition goes underground and the extreme elements in the terrorist groups are members of oppressed political opposition. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please do stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News. That's coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC. For another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.